is no sign of your intelligence to confirm that all religions are going up the same mountain. You have to deny the fundamental teachings of the religions of the world to come to that conclusion.
Craig Parton, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Religion on Trial, Cross-Examining Religious Truth Claims.
They may all be wrong, but do any of them ask to be tested by the canons of evidence used in the law, science, and history?
Learn more about Religion on Trial at issuesetc.org. I don't know where it's going to stop. It doesn't show any sign of stopping. Right now, as we speak in the halls of academia and elsewhere, there are people who are rifling through the writings of famous men, through their sayings, their memoirs, their journals, their public writings in their papers. They're looking, apparently, for the smallest scrap, the smallest sign of racism. Then, immediately, there's a paper written. There is a blog post posted, and we learn that this person, esteemed for so many other reasons in our history, was actually a racist. Sometimes it's based upon just a smattering of words, and sometimes it might be based on some real evidence. But why the hunt? Why the ongoing quest for evidence of racism in our public life? What's going on here? Welcome back to Issues Etc. On this Thursday afternoon, we're going to be joined by Pastor Hans Feeney to talk about two issues: allegations of racism against Albert Einstein, and then a little bit later, we'll get his pastoral perspective on Alzheimer's disease. Pastor Hans Feeney is pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois, creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire, senior contributor to The Federalist, and author of a recent column there titled Calling Einstein a Racist is Perfect for Those Who Can't Compete with His Accomplishments. Hans, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be back.
In a bigger sense, is this kind of digging up the alleged racism of Albert Einstein part of what you and others have called outrage addiction?
Yeah, I think it's sort of a subspecies of it. So the typical outrage addiction, I think, that you see is, you know, if you're on Twitter or social media and you all of a sudden see people sharing, you know, some tweet that someone posted that someone you've never really even heard of before, or at least someone who has very little impact on your average daily life, and going nuts about that and screaming at this person and talking about what a wretched human being this person is for thinking what they thought or doing what they did. That, I think, is kind of the typical versions of outrage addiction that you find, where people wake up and they're looking for something to get angry about. So, and they just kind of glom onto whatever it is that they can find and whatever is going to give them the quickest, easiest hit that morning. And I think that this is something similar. It's sort of like a cousin of outrage addiction. I think it's a little bit different in that in instances like this with Albert Einstein, or something similar I saw recently with an Association of Librarians renaming the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award because, good heavens, she wrote some words that were insensitive towards American Indians and maybe some other groups during her time. You don't find in these kind of things the same sort of level of outrage. You don't quite find people posting this stuff and screaming and wailing about what racists Einstein and Laura Ingalls Wilder or whoever else it may be. It's more so kind of along the idea of, I see this more as an extension of taking down monuments. So it's this idea that these are these people in history who are considered to be accomplished. And it's very similar to the outrage addiction in that people who are filled with a kind of guilt and self-loathing, perhaps, are trying to manage that somehow, and so they're trying to aim their ire in someone else's direction. But in this case, it's, I think, more so an attempt to kind of take away from people's accomplishments and hack away at their reputation as being beneficial to society, and that's happening from people who feel like they probably have very few accomplishments and very little value in society themselves.
So what did someone find in, I take it this is now the private writings of Albert Einstein,
right,
to suggest that he was a terrible racist individual?
Right. So in 1922, I believe it was, Einstein went on a tour of the East, tour of Asia, and kind of all throughout the continent and the islands. And during that time, he wrote down private thoughts about the Chinese and the Japanese and other folks that he came into contact with, that would not meet current 2018 standards of full, unfiltered wokeness. So he said things like looking at the Chinese, he thought they were a rather dirty or filthy people, which I'm guessing means that a lot of them were peasants who were not whose clothing wasn't terribly clean, which was probably fairly true in 1922. That it would be it was a dreary thought to imagine the Chinese basically outbreeding the rest of the world. That was basically the extent of it.
How would you set that in its context to understand Albert Einstein? In first of all, we are talking about a private writing. This isn't something that he wrote in a paper and decided to publish in a scientific journal, his observations about the inferiority or something like that of the Asian people. But how would you set it in its context?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at a couple of things. First of all, it was a different era when people were not driven by the same kind of attempt to make everyone in every circumstance and every context feel welcome all the time. So it was just a different world in which people didn't exactly approach life that way. He was also, as I kind of noted before, he was dealing at a time when there was obviously far greater poverty in countries like China than you would find today. You would find far greater poverty in 1922 all throughout the world than you would today. And likewise, again, as you noted, it's important to note that these were private thoughts. So this wasn't something that he was publishing in a journal. It's not something that he was writing down so that he could use it as evidence in pursuit of some sort of goal of ethnic cleansing or anything of that nature, or to use it in order to lobby people against civil rights legislation or things of that nature. These were just simply private thoughts of a guy kind of trying to catalog the things that popped into his head when he was on a trip.
So back to the bigger picture here, what do you think is at work here? Why this? It seems to be a several stage process. First, we have to find the racism, then we have to expose it. And then here's the thing that just puzzles me. We have to expunge it, even from the history books. And I was speaking recently with Holly Shear about the very subject you mentioned just a moment ago, an attempt to kind of quell reading of the Laura Ingalls Wilder's book because she said things that were for her time, just kind of what people thought about Native Americans. And the same has been done with the works of Mark Twain. Why the attempt to expunge these things, be it statues or history or literature?
I think really it's just this simple. It's that you have a large percentage of younger-ish people who have grown up either not in the church at all or who have grown up with a form of Christianity that is very questionably Christianity. They have received very little Jesus. And so they still maintain a very worldly understanding of how salvation works, namely that the way you become acceptable and pleasing in the eyes of God is that you make yourself into a worthy person, that you just simply earn salvation, you earn the favor of God, and kind of along with that, you earn the favor of the world by being a good person. And then they ultimately take their own definition of what does it mean to be a good person? And it's sort of crafted around, this is kind of the sort of what I like to call a Pharisaical trick, which is, you know, the Pharisees, when they would look at the Ten Commandments and their understanding of the law of God, they determined that basically the things they were good at were the things that God really cared about. So, you know, whether you were tithing, you know, your spices and things of this nature, whether you had a profoundly restrictive definition of, you know, working on the Sabbath and not healing people and things of that nature, and whether you had love for people and compassion for people, was God couldn't possibly care as much about that. So it's just kind of determining, looking at the biography of your own life and determining what God values based off of that. And this is kind of the same thing that people do today, where they go, well, we're kind of a sexually libertine people, and we don't really have any regard for our elders and for our parents, and we kind of live in service of ourselves and in love of material possessions, but by golly, we have really progressive views on race and human sexuality, and we accept people of all groups. So that's the most important thing in the world, and if I have that, if I can give conclusive proof that I am not a racist, I don't need to do anything else. I don't need to accomplish anything else. I don't need to build or develop or create anything else. And this is how they are able to kind of develop this strange mindset where you can look at someone, you know, as accomplished as Einstein and go, yeah, but you know what? He was racist and I'm not. So the point of the matter in the end is not so much that Einstein was racist and therefore we should strip all of his writings from history, or that Laura Ingalls Wilder was racist and that we should erase her writings from history. The point is more so, I am not racist, unlike Laura Ingalls Wilder. Here's what I have accomplished. My accomplishment of being not racist is greater than hers. And it's actually, I think, just the act of trying to kind of memory hole someone and remove their presence from history. Not because they really need to be removed, but because the mere act of doing so is a manifestation of how profoundly and beautifully non-racist you are.
Pastor Hans Feeney is our guest on this Thursday afternoon. When we come back, we will turn to a subject, graver subject, in fact, his pastoral perspective on Alzheimer's disease and those who suffer from it. Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. You can promote your confessional Lutheran church and support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining our congregational sponsorship program, the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. You'll find an informational flyer on the support page at issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. The Issues Etc. 300.
Whether you're a man yourself or a woman who cares about the men in your life, you won't want to miss the June issue of The Lutheran Witness. Join John Kleinig, Hans Feeney, Jeffrey Hemmer, Broer Erickson, and others in this power-packed issue on men at church as they explore toxic masculinity, godly fatherhood, the religious gender gap, and more. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Children are a heritage from the Lord, but what of those who've not been given the gift of a child? The cross of barrenness affects not only childless couples, it affects the family, friends, and pastors who love and care for them. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm partnering with Emmanuel Press to publish the second edition of my book, He Remembers the Barren, a story about the hope and contentment found only in Christ, no matter the cross we bear. Visit emmanuelpress.us to learn more. emmanuelpress.us.
Have you ever wanted to better understand philosophy and its impact on your family, your church, or your world, but didn't know where to begin? Concordia University, Wisconsin has an innovative, free online course for you entitled Philosophy Kata Christan. These six engaging video sessions are taught by noted Lutheran philosopher, lecturer, author, and pastor, Dr. Gregory Scholz. Learn more by clicking the Kata Christan logo at issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Hans Feeney is our guest. We're turning the subject matter of our conversation to his pastoral perspective on Alzheimer's. Hans, you've recently written about this subject. This is a deeply painful subject for many people, those who have or who have known someone who has suffered from Alzheimer's. This is a condition and a disease that is, as those who will have gone through it will tell you, can really only be experienced to be fully understood. But you've made an attempt to explain what it's like for those who suffer it and what it's like for those who love those who suffer from it. And I think a lot of people think about it as, well, you just get forgetful. You just lose your memories. How would you correct that view?
Yeah, I'd say that it's more so that you lose the context of your memories more than losing the memories themselves. So the way I would describe it is that imagine that your memories are sort of collections of books that are all bound together and they've all got various stories and characters and events and settings and things of that nature. And you have a bunch of different books that are all bound together with a common theme. You know, so you've got a book on the time that you spent, on vacation when you went to Disney World, or you've got a book on, your sophomore year of high school, and a book on your, first year of marriage and things of that nature. And what seems to happen with Alzheimer's is that it's like Alzheimer's walks into the room, and instead of just setting books on fire or ripping out and throwing away pages of specific memories, it's like what Alzheimer's does is it rips the spines out of every book and then just scatters the pages all around the library floor, so that it removes from you the ability to properly store and categorize and collect the events that have happened to you, which makes it harder to maintain the memories. And they just eventually, without a context for understanding them, they just kind of rot away. So it's the way I would describe it is it's a bit like if you've ever experienced that thing where you see someone that you know you're supposed to know. You see some guy and you know his face from somewhere, but you can't remember where you know him from, and that's why you can't remember his name, and you can't have a hard time figuring out anything else to do with him because you don't have the context to attach a name to his face. So if you imagine that, but just with every single memory that you have, that's essentially what it is that Alzheimer's does to people.
So let's talk a little bit about, you have a great suggestion that needs to begin early in life to kind of weave the most important thing into all those memories that may someday, as you have said, get completely disconnected from one another.
Yeah, so the what seems to me to be kind of the case with people who have Alzheimer's is that the more that an entire story exists on one page of their memories, the easier time they have remembering that. I think this tends to be why, this may not be a universal rule, but certainly in my experience, people who've had Alzheimer's, like men who have had Alzheimer's, they remember their wives and they remember their mothers, and while everyone else is kind of filtering away, precisely because the memories that they do have, it's very clear from the context of that. That's all kind of on one page. So my recommendation for people from a pastoral perspective is to put Jesus, the full story of Christ crucified, on every memory that you can and in every page of every book that you've got, both for yourself and for your children, so that you know who Christ is, that when you have very little left, that any memory that's associated with the church, any memory that's associated with praying with your parents or with your children, all of these things, that they're all rooted in the promise of Christ crucified for your sins. That the more times that Jesus appears in his full context in that collection of your memories, the better off you will be and the better off your children will be, because as every other memory fades away, there Christ will remain.
Just any pastor worth his salt who spent time with people or parishioners who suffered from any kind of dementia, memory loss, or Alzheimer's, they know, or they've observed, I've heard it hundreds of times, and I do not exaggerate, observed that there's a certain staying power to those things that are associated with the worship life of God's people, to the Lord's Prayer, to the beloved hymns, to beloved psalms and Bible passages. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's something I've definitely seen in my time as a pastor. I remember a number of years ago when I was serving a congregation out in Colorado, I would go to see a member of mine who had Alzheimer's. And this was a guy who couldn't remember the name of the woman he'd been married to for 40-some-odd years, couldn't remember how old he was, when his birthday was, or anything of that nature. And yet he could still sing every single word of the liturgy. So God has a remarkable ability to kind of tuck his word into corners of people's brains where the Alzheimer's beast just can't seem to find them. It's a really beautiful thing to see, and I think this is, to me, one of really the best and strongest arguments you can make in favor of maintaining a consistent use of the historic liturgy of the church. So when people grow up hearing the same thing and singing the same things as children and all throughout their lives, it is able to not only to put Jesus into so many memories that you have, but it's able to kind of burn these words and these notes and these songs into our brains in a way where the devil is just never able to use Alzheimer's to take these things away from us. So So while it's certainly understandable why it is that people of a certain age tend to get a little bored and restless, you know, singing the same liturgy and doing the same divine service settings that they've done their entire lives, it's, I understand why people find novelty to be attractive. But we need to be good stewards of our resources that we have. And being a good steward of the resources and the gifts that God has given you, in a lot of ways, means training your brain and your heart to be able to cling to something so that the devil can't take those things away from you. And one day, we're all going to get older. One day, your children are going to get older. And when your children get older, and if their brains ever start falling apart on them, they're going to need to have that word tucked into those corners of their brain where Alzheimer's can't get to it. And the more that you give them a consistent use of the historic liturgy of the church, the better off they'll be.
Finally, with about a minute here, Hans, there is the natural concern of loved ones who are watching mom or dad or grandma or grandpa go through this, that they may lose all memory, and then they wonder, will they then also lose faith? What are your pastoral words there when all these things are fading away?
Well, I'd say one of the important things to remember whenever you have people in your life that are struggling with this is that Jesus has promised to be the good shepherd. He's promised that his sheep are going to know his voice, and he has promised that he is going to keep calling out to his sheep, proclaiming his word of forgiveness to them and feeding them with his salvation. So while it's certainly true that there is an intellectual component to the Christian faith, it's certainly not a biblical notion that if you lose your ability to remember who your wife is, that you have therefore lost your ability to remember who Christ is and therefore can't be saved. There's absolutely no reason to conclude anything of that nature from the scriptural testimony. Rather, the scriptural testimony is quite simply that our good shepherd will not abandon us, and even if we lose every other memory we have, Christ will still hold us in his arms. Our good shepherd will still cling to us. And so even if we have forgotten every other voice in this world, we will still remember the voice of our shepherd.
Pastor Hans Feeney is pastor of River of Life Lutheran Church in Shanahan, Illinois. He is creator of a series of comical videos called Lutheran Satire. He's senior contributor to The Federalist and author of a recent column there titled Calling Einstein a Racist is Perfect for Those Who Can't Compete with His Accomplishments. You can read that for yourself at our website as well. Click Listen on Demand, issuesetc.org. Hans, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., it's This Week in Pop American Christianity with Chris Roseborough. And since Friday looms, we will be playing Issues Etc., Soundbite of the Week. The Issues Etc. journal is absolutely free and it's online. You can subscribe by going to our website, issuesetc.org, click the red button and enter your email address, and you'll get the latest Issues Etc. journal containing an article that I've written called Confessions of a Well-Intentioned Preacher. Read it for free online, issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hey Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Jesus the Good Shepherd says, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life." We invite you to join us as we listen to the voice of the Good Shepherd and follow him who gives us eternal life. Sunday worship services at 9 a.m., Sunday school and Bible class at 10:30, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri, on the web at goodshepherdarnold.org. That's goodshepherdarnold.org.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.